From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners, and we're very, very thankful for that. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Buddha didn't create us. Mohammed didn't create us. It's the God of the Holy Scriptures. They didn't bring a Quran over on the pilgrim ship Mayflower.
This bill, in my judgment, is nothing but an excuse to discriminate, to tell a gay couple you can't have a marriage license.
Earlier this month, a congressional committee held a hearing on oversight of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Interfaith Alliance Executive Director Rabbi Jack Moline submitted written testimony to the committee members, urging a balanced approach to ensuring constitutional rights for all in this crucial area of our civic life. At the same time, differing legislation with similar names to the RFRA has been passed in some and introduced in more of the states nationwide. On this week's show, Jack will be with us in the studio to talk about the risks and benefits of this kind of lawmaking, as well as the other urgent issues facing those of us who believe in truly defending faith and freedom.
I have been asked to find out what happened before, during, and after Benghazi, and I need her records to do that, and I cannot take her lawyer's word that he went through and used all the right search terms.
And it's been, frankly, remarkable to me. To the extent to which the White House has attacked the Prime Minister, attacked me, for wanting to hear from one of our closest allies.
This deal that is being negotiated by the Obama administration is profoundly dangerous, both to the security of our friend and ally Israel, but also to American national security. I believe this deal...
So it was intended to get in the way of the deal?
It was intended to stop a bad deal. Absolutely.
That last voice belongs to U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, who this past week confirmed that at least for some who signed the ill-conceived letter to the Iranian government undercutting President Obama's authority in negotiating a nuclear deal was not just a risk. That was the objective. It seems that this and a growing number of other vitally important policy matters are being treated as chess pieces on the playing board of domestic politics. On this week's show, I'll check that perception with George Washington University's Greg LaBelle. But first, we head to Europe.
More and more European Jews are asking if it's time to leave. European governments seem unable to prevent rising terrorist attacks against Jews, and that's made Jews as fearful as they've been since the Holocaust.
Terry Schwartzberg is American-born, Jewish, and he's lived for decades in Germany. As reports of anti-Semitism multiply, both in the U.S. and in Europe, his commitment to visibility in his city of Munich, Germany, challenges some contemporary assumptions about the state of interreligious relations. Terry's also a leading activist with the Stolperstein Project, and I am very pleased to welcome Terry now to State of Belief Radio. Terry, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
You know, you have made international headlines with what would appear to be a pretty simple act of public visibility. Tell our listeners about how you decided to wear a kippah whenever you wanted to, wherever you went, and why some members of your community thought that was a very dangerous idea.
I have been wearing a kippah, which many of your listeners will probably know as a yarmulke, since December 1st, 2012. In other words, I have been living my normal life in Munich, taking my kids to swimming lessons, to school, shopping, wherever I was taken, I've always just put on a kippah on my head and walked around. And it was a very controversial move because most Jews in Germany live in absolute fear of being identified as being Jewish. In other words, most of them refuse to read Hebrew newspapers in public or wear Stars of David or anything like that. And I decided to show them that there's no reason to live in fear in Germany. You all have all heard of Schindler's List. The man behind it was a Polish-Jewish gentleman named Mitek Pemper. It was his idea. He created the list. He convinced Schindler to do it. He died in 2012 in Augsburg, he was 91, and a very celebrated person, and I was at his funeral. I'm a friend of the family, and it was at the Jewish cemetery. All the men were wearing yarmulkes, were wearing kippot. You know, I'm Jewish. I've seen Jews, Reform Jews, I'm a Reform Jew, all throughout New York and Brooklyn. I see normal Jews wearing normal kippot every day, and I thought, oh, that's nice. Maybe I'll just keep on my kippah as we left this Jewish cemetery. As soon as we crossed the border from the cemetery back into the streets of Augsburg, all the Jews began screaming at me, take off your kippah, you're endangering us. And I thought to myself, if wearing a little round piece of cloth puts everybody in danger, I am living in the wrong country. And I decided I would prove that Germany is safe for Jews. And I think I have. And as a matter of fact, I've been doing this for 27 months. Not a single bad thing, and many wonderful things have happened to me.
Would you say then, Terry, that a lot of people must have an exaggerated idea of danger in their present-day lives?
Yes, I think it is exaggerated, and I hope my example, my role model, has convinced him to feel otherwise. But in actual fact, Jews in Germany still live in fear 70 years after the Shoah, after the Holocaust, and I think that's totally unfounded. And if you look at the statistics, Jews are safe in America. And they're also equally safe in Germany. There are very few anti-Semitic incidents. There were 24 last year of any description, and there's almost 200,000 Jews now in Germany. So the chances of experiencing that as a Jew is about as great as having, you know, congealed water from an airplane fall on your head. It's very minor.
So where does the fear come from?
Well, I think it comes from, first of all, I hate to say it, although I'm a journalist, I think the media has had a bad role in doing that. I think they've taken these minor incidents and blown them up. I think the recent comments by Netanyahu were not helpful, suggesting that all European Jews should emigrate to Israel. And I think the people themselves, the way it works is the more you hide, the more you're afraid, the more you will become afraid. In other words, if you go out, embrace the society, check out your fears, then you will see that German society is very progressive, very tolerant, and very non-racist. But if you're sitting there worrying about it and don't do anything, any minor thing can set you off. And that's why I have no fear of German society, because I go out there every day with my kippah on.
In your mind, does it attract attention? Does it prompt conversation? Or are you just another person on the street?
The sad truth is, I love attention, but 99.9% of the people don't even cast me a glance. They're just used to, you know, a cosmopolitan crowd. But I have had very heartwarming experiences. I was, my daughter, who was in those days, she was 7. We were visiting a friend at Augsburg, a city to the west of Munich, and we were rushing to catch a train. It was dark. It was 5 o'clock in the afternoon in December. And as we were rushing, a huge man approached me, and he was wearing a green bomber jacket. Hadn't shaved for 5 days. He had a lot of curly hair. Looked very impressive. I'm a rather large man myself, but certainly an impressive figure. And he said to me in German, of course, he says, "Are you from Jerusalem?" And I said, "No, I'm actually from Wisconsin." I asked him where he was from. He said he's from Algeria. And I waited to see what was going to happen, because he was obviously Muslim. And he said to me, "I just wanted to stop you and tell you, I think it's great that Jews are showing their identity, are showing being visible in Germany. We Muslims should do that." And he gave me a hug, and he gave me a kiss on both cheeks, which was very painful for me because of his beard. And we both laughed. My daughter laughed because she had never seen two men hugging each other like that. And my daughter and I rushed off to the train. I've had lots of experiences like that. No bad experiences, lots of very heartwarming experiences. Jews come up to me all the time and say, "Oh, by the way, I'm Jewish. I'm from Israel. I think it's great that you're wearing a kippah." So it's been a very good thing for me, actually.
If people perceive the world around us to be more hostile and even more dangerous than it really is, there is a lot to be lost by that.
I completely subscribe to that idea. I think we do create our own realities. And if we are open and friendly and positive, we can have wonderful experiences. And I think it's very important to see how far Germany has come in the last 70 years. I am having kippot, these, you know, plural kippahs, I'm having them made, and they're going to have mazel tov, which, of course, you know what that means. Congratulations. On them, with the colors of the German flag. and with signs of Christianity and Judaism and Islam woven in. And I'm going to give them for free to everybody, and I hope we'll get some flash mobs together, ecumenical flash mobs, where people come out and say, we are for tolerance, we are for interreligious understanding, and we're all standing together. All Abrahamic religions are standing together, and I think we'll be doing that in a few weeks.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's great. Terry, I know you devote a lot of your time to working on the Stolperstein Project. Will you talk about that?
Yes, I would love to. I think it's not quite as well known in America as it is in Europe. Stolperstein means stumbling blocks, and they're plaques, they're brass plaques, about hand size that are placed on the sidewalks in front of the buildings where Jews and gypsies and gays and lesbians and everybody lived before being dragged off to concentration camps. Nazis killed 11 million people. 6 million of them were Jews. And each person deserves to be remembered, and that's what the Stolperstein are doing. If you lost family members in the Shoah and the Holocaust, you can order a Stolperstein made, and then we put them in the ground. It's a very moving ceremony. And then there are now 54,000 Stolperstein in 1,200 cities in 18 countries. This is a huge thing. In Berlin alone, there are 6,100 Stolperstein. And they're very moving, and you stumble across them. But that's what happens. You're walking down the street, and all of a sudden you see a glint of gold, and you bend over and you read about somebody who was killed in a concentration camp. And it means that Germany is now, and also the other European countries, are now atoning for all the horrible things they did on the Shoah on a victim-by-victim basis, and they will do so for generations to come. In other words, Germany is now engaged in the world's largest project of commemoration of atonement, and I think that's something wonderful.
I know that our listeners want to know how to find out more about your work and to keep up with it. Tell them how to stay in touch with you and learn from what you're doing.
Check me out on Facebook. I'm on Facebook. My initiative, Stolperstein, is on Facebook. Just give me a friendship request on Facebook. I would be delighted to hook up with you people. I think you're doing marvelous work, as I've seen in America. Very interested to get to know what you're doing.
Terry Schwartzberg is an American-born Jewish resident of Munich, Germany. 2 years ago, he felt moved to challenge Jewish invisibility in his city by wearing his kippah on a daily basis. The experience has challenged common assumptions about risks of hostility and even dangers associated with being visibly Jewish. Terry, thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
And may I say thank you so much for the opportunity of sharing my story. I hope that it inspires others. Thank you so much.
Greg LaBelle is the veteran of several presidential campaigns. He brings an insider's familiarity of how political decisions get made at the highest levels. Today, he is assistant professor of political management at George Washington University, where he heads up the Semester in Washington program. With more and more major policy debates seeming to be happening in purely partisan political terms, I'm happy to have Greg back with us in the studio to get his expert take on how bad it really is. And Greg, I just tell you up front, I wanted this segment because I want to know what is really serious and what's just sheer politics. Well, so we'll get on to that.
Yeah.
Greg, welcome back to State of Belief.
It's great to be here, Weldon. It's nice to see you.
Bibi's speech, Hillary's emails, the letter to Iran, the Lynch confirmation. Are the wheels of government really grinding to a halt because of partisanship, or does it just feel that way?
It feels that way because it is that way. We're going through a very unique time in American politics, I think. And I think there are a number of reasons for it. But I think there is reason to be concerned. I think that we are losing sight of policy goals and replacing them with political goals. And I think that's a very dangerous thing, place for us to be.
Is that being done instinctively, deliberately, because there are so many new members of Congress that don't have experience on this? What's causing it?
Well, it's all of the above. Let's take a couple of factors. I think that let's start with the media. If we look at how the media has changed how it covers politics over the last couple of generations, I think we see a significant change. Matt Bai, the reporter at New York Times, wrote what I think is really a great book called All the News is Out, about that change back in the mid-80s. It really goes back to the Watergate era, though, and a significant shift in the way politics is covered in this country. And it's increasingly been covered with more and more focus on specific instances of abuse or questionable actions and so on and so forth, with a lot less attention being paid to the sort of the bigger picture, to the larger issues that we're facing. Sarah Palin called it gotcha journalism, and I think it's one thing she got right. There is a sense of gotcha journalism, I think, that we're dealing with right now. And I think that has bled over into our politics. I think we are now in an era of gotcha politics. So you've got this significant change. I think another change that we've observed over a couple of generations is the homogeneity of those districts, those congressional districts. They have become more and more homogenous, in part because people have increasingly sort of separated themselves from each other based on their political beliefs, I mean, literally and figuratively, not only in what TV they watch, but literally in sort of where they live. And that's been exacerbated by the drawing of lines, congressional district lines every 10 years, which both parties have done to increase the likelihood of hanging on to seats. So you got increasingly homogenous districts. So these members of Congress are speaking to a much increasingly narrow group of people every time we turn around. Conservative members of Congress have to keep that right edge happy if they're going to stay in office. Liberal members of Congress have to do the same thing. One other thing, and you alluded to it, I think we've watched this happen in the House for the last few years. Now we're seeing it happen in the Senate. And I think if you look at the numbers, I don't have the exact numbers, but I think you'll see that there are a lot more former members of the House of Representatives who are now in the Senate than is historically the case. Mm-hmm. So these guys sort of come in with this kind of red meat politics, which is how they survive in the House of Representatives. And they bring that into the Senate. And now you see it beginning to have an impact on the way the Senate functions. So it's not just the House, but now both houses of Congress are approaching issues this way. And it's not a good thing.
Greg, I mentioned as we began the speech of Netanyahu, Hillary's emails, letter to Iran, the delay on the Attorney General decision. Mm. Which of these stories would you highlight as the most dangerous one with which to play politics?
Oh, can I pick two?
Yeah.
I got to pick two. And I'll start with the letter to the Iranian government. This was an example of utter naivete on the part of the authors. Senator Cotton clearly thought he was doing something different than what he was doing. Now we have members of the Senate who signed the bill sort of second-guessing whether or not they should have signed it. John McCain said something like, "I signed lots of letters," was his response for why he signed this letter. The interesting thing about this, of course, is that in general, this was seen as a very bad idea. Senator Cotton has become the darling of the right wing of the Republican Party now. And where does Senator Cotton need to play? To the right wing of the Republican Party. So the letter wasn't maybe the brightest thing to do. It worked for him politically. The other thing is the Netanyahu speech. When the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives invites the head of a foreign government to address a joint session of Congress and doesn't tell the president, this is another amazing breach of protocol. And within that word of protocol, there's trust and respect and all sorts of other things that sort of fit into that word. These were two, I think, really appalling occurrences.
I know you've been in tight places. Let's just imagine that you're in the current administration. What would you be telling the administration to do in handling these two cases that you just talked about?
Well, first of all, there's a history to these events that got us to these events. And I guess if I could rewind the clock and go back a few years, I'd have a better attempt at answering that question, because what we've seen is a continual breakdown of certainly communication between the leadership of the Republican Party on the Hill and the White House. We look back to 2011, I think, the grand bargain when we were trying to keep the government open and Boehner was meeting with the president to work out some sort of grand bargain. The collapse of that was really, really significant, and I think an important turning point in that relationship, and maybe to the point that it was irreparable from that point on. Both the president and the speaker were pushed by their constituents when this thing was being developed. But I think what we really saw was a speaker, the Speaker of the House, really lose control of his caucus in the House of Representatives. So I think had the two parties been able to work together back then, I think we may not be where we are now. What do we do now? It's really difficult to say because we're really at a point where it's almost all-out war between these factions. The president has made an effort to play nice with the Republican leadership, and then he said, "Okay, we're not playing nice anymore. I'm gonna get serious. I'm gonna start using the phone and the pen." The Republican leadership of the House and now the Senate will say the president is dishonest, is not dealing with us fairly, is not talking with us at all. We're almost in fourth grade where we have to send the two to their corners.
So is the president in need of doing a better job, or is the partisanship bigger than any of the characters in this?
The partisanship has become bigger than any of the players in this. That's why it sort of said, you know, if we go back a few years, there may have been a point, there would have been a point, I think, where we may have been able to take a different path, but that path wasn't taken. It's very difficult for me to see how these players begin to work together. You know, an example of this is the Netanyahu, the election in Israel yesterday. Netanyahu won more seats than people thought he was going to win, and what people are considering a pretty significant victory. And one of the headlines I saw here was raise Israeli elections loser : Obama. Where is the attention to the common good, to international relations, to what's best for Israel, what's best for the United States in that kind of mindset? It's just not there. It's not there.
Greg, who is in the best position to fix this?
You know, we as Americans are really at our best when we're in a crisis. I think we've proven that time and time again in the history of this country. The question for me is, when do we get to that point where we say, okay, this is a crisis. We've really got to fix this. And I look at the players, the folks who are being considered contenders for the presidency in 2016. And I can say with some confidence that the person who steps forward to help mend this situation will be a surprise. I don't think we see it in any of the leading contenders right now. It may be someone who's not running yet. It may be someone who doesn't come in 2016. We may have to go through a lot more of this before we get there. But it's got to come to a point in this country where enough people say, a pox on both your houses, we've got to do something. And we're not there yet.
Okay, so getting there is going to be painful.
Yeah.
Talk for a second about the cost of opportunity that's being in sway as this gets worse and worse.
Oh, there are a number of losses of opportunities in this. Again, because our political leaders are not looking at, as I said, they're not looking at the common good. They're not looking at what's best for the country. You know, I'm old enough to remember when Tip O'Neill and Bob Michael, as Speaker of the House and Minority Leader, after the session every day would go to the Speaker's office and sit down and share a bourbon and talk about sort of, okay, how do we get from here to there? That's not part of the debate anymore. It's not happening officially, and from what anyone can tell, it's not happening unofficially. It's simply not part of the process. When the political leaders in this country are not having those kinds of conversations, don't have the kind of inherent respect for each other and their opinions to be able to work these issues through, it doesn't happen. I used to tell my students, decry the situation and say, I remember when if you disagreed with me, you were wrong. Now it seems if you disagree with me, you're evil. And I think we've even gone beyond that. If you disagree with me, I'm going to wreck you. I'm going to find a way to destroy your career. That seems to be where we've gotten. So the number of opportunities in international affairs, in dealing with the problems that face this country, in dealing with issues like Ferguson, we can't address them if we're not talking to each other. And we're not talking to each other.
Yeah, I think we don't like each other. We have moved from political competition, which was a noble act, part of the art of politics, to just not liking each other and shutting down the debate. And without the debate, you don't have what you need for a democracy.
And I think one of the problems, to get really down into the weeds, is I think one of the problems is that I was going to say, I wonder how many members of Congress could actually took and could pass a basic civics course. But I think we can apply that to the nation as a whole. As we've watched legislation play itself out, the way people have reacted to what has been the standard basis of how we govern this country with compromise and agreements and trade-offs and so on. I mean, that's what American democracy is based on. But we look at this, we watch Americans watch this, and they're angry that that's how this is done, because there's a my way or the highway mentality that affects both voters and leaders. And I don't know which one started it, but it's clearly where we are. So there's that you're right. We don't like each other. We don't want to hear each other.
Now, we've got a lot of voters in the United States that I guess some of them really get high on this kind of meanness. But I want you to say one word of advice for voters who are sick unto death of the way things are now being done in Washington.
One of the big challenges, as we talked about at the beginning, sort of the way our congressional districts have sort of been divvied up to lean pretty seriously one way or the other, there are people in those districts who don't fit into that category. We need to find a mechanism that allows those folks' voices to be heard. We are hearing from a relatively small group of very loud, oftentimes very well-funded and well-prepared people on both sides of the aisle. Mm-hmm. It's all of those folks in the middle whose opinions are not being heard. Now, this is not an old problem. I mean, this has always been the case in this country. But I think because of all these things we've been talking about, it has become a much more serious problem because the microphones are there now. The development of technology and so on and so forth and new skills that are being used by special interests, I think, have magnified those voices on the edge. So the voices in the middle are being completely squashed. So somehow I think the answer is to figure out how to give those folks an opportunity to say, here's what I think. This is not an either-or situation. I'm neither all the way on the left nor on the right. There are solutions that are here, but we're not hearing them and we're not seeing them. And it doesn't do any good for most members of Congress to address them because that's not who they're talking to.
Greg LaBelle is Assistant Professor of Political Management at George Washington University. He's the veteran of several presidential campaigns, and he is our go-to guy when we need to understand how things work or don't work inside the Beltway, even when we're in a situation like we're in right now where there doesn't seem to be anything working. Greg, as always, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Weldon. It's good to see you.
Last week, the state of Utah passed a law enumerating protections for LGBT persons in employment and housing, at the same time offering broad religious exemptions. The support of a large majority in the state's GOP-dominated legislature, as well as the Mormon Church, including one prominent leader who has close ties to the extremist anti-gay World Congress of Families, has made many LGBT advocates suspicious. With religious language at the center of separate legislation regarding who can claim a conscience exemption regarding marriage equality and the right to discriminate spelled out in a growing list of state-level religious freedom acts nationwide, well, there's plenty to keep those of us working to protect both faith and freedom very busy. At the forefront of that effort is Rabbi Jack Moline, Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance. And as always, I'm delighted to welcome him on State of Belief Radio. Jack, welcome.
Thank you, Welton.
You recently submitted testimony to a congressional committee regarding the Federal Restoration of Religious Freedom Act. Would you first talk about where you draw the line on this issue, because it is so vulnerable to misapplication of the language of religious freedom as an excuse to discriminate? So tell us about where you are.
So I think everybody who is on the left side of this issue is a little surprised at how the Religious Freedom Restoration Act has been used in ways that it was never intended, which is to exempt individuals from observance of laws that were enacted for the general good. Without it, we are going to find ourselves in a situation in which our society is atomized over the question of religion again. And I just don't want to see that happen. Mm. We have a society in which the common good is at the center of our constitutional government. If you read the preamble of the Constitution, the mission statement of the United States is there. A more perfect union, the general welfare, the common defense, us and our posterity, all of us together. And to use this Religious Freedom Restoration Act to create, as one of my colleagues calls it, RFRA madness, mm-hmm. in order to continue the exclusionary practices that America was founded to eliminate, I think is simply wrong. And that's why we have to work against that use of it.
Is it too severe to say that people in the states who didn't agree with RFRA and who wanted it to be more accommodating to their particular point of view are now using state legislatures to put in place ideas that really were contradictory to the federal document?
We're seeing that all over the country. And while there's a certain amount of sympathy in my heart for people who feel that their so-called traditional values are being challenged by the opening of religious freedom to people of all persuasions, it's no excuse for using the law as a weapon.
Mm. What are your thoughts about the so-called Utah Compromise? That's another tricky one to parse.
Yeah, you know, I need to say right from the start that I am a fan of the adherents of the LDS Church. I find them to be people of deep-seated family values and commitments to godliness as they interpret it. And I'm happy to see that they have a self-reflective nature that has been something that has typified their march forward into the 21st century. Mm-hmm. But I also think that the influence that they seem to have over the Utah State Legislature is probably the best argument to preserve the protections of the First Amendment to separate church and state. Because it's true that without the support of the Mormon Church, this law would never have been passed. If they had opposed it, the state legislature wouldn't have considered anything that would have secured the rights of LGBT individuals. So it is a mixed blessing. I think we need to take our cue from people of different sexual orientation who live in the state of Utah. They are the ones most affected by this law, and I think we need to support their efforts to secure the rights that they feel are more accessible to them now. But at the same time, I don't think we can let up our conversations with people who would get in the way of their full participation in the whole panoply of activities of American society.
Jack, I know, as you said, you're trying to keep an eye on RFRA in state houses across the country. Specifically, what's the role of Interfaith Alliance allies on the ground, particularly in jurisdictions that may not have a local affiliate of the alliance in place? What do people need to be watching closely about for what's going on?
So first and foremost, an informed citizenry can be a responsible citizenry. People in the localities and in the states need to be looking very carefully at the language of these state religious freedom proposals to make sure that they are not reinstituting the very prejudices and biases that the original RFRA was meant to take away. If there's a law that exempts, for example, people who run commercial enterprises, which are voluntary activities on the part of any citizen, from upholding the rights and privileges that are part of American citizenhood, that's not a good law. Our religious convictions in this country are protected, but they're not definitive. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a right to say that the restaurants in my neighborhood can't serve pork because I keep kosher. That's simply not something that I can do.
Well, I know that this is a major focus of Interfaith Alliance, but I also know that you're busy about a lot of other concerns as well. What else is on the plate?
I think that my heart is closest right now to the frustration that a lot of American Muslims feel about their role in our society. There is so much language in our national discussion now about how we're going to combat people who've taken Islam to an extreme and used it as an excuse to do some very unreligious stuff, ungodly stuff. I'm worried about the Muslim population, that even if there is no indication that our government is going to act against the Muslim community, I know what it means to be part of a minority that is the subject of unpleasant language that seems to envelop the innocent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of our major concerns as well. And, well, now I'll tell you, we like everyone else, are looking at 2016 and wondering what the issues are going to be. We're discussing what our focus should be for those elections, what questions we want to encourage people to ask of the candidates, and how we can emphasize our collective responsibility rather than our individual rights as being central to the American endeavor.
Mm-hmm. Jack, on this show, every week before we get off the air, I encourage people to join Interfaith Alliance. I really would like for you to take just a couple of minutes to encourage listeners to become more directly involved in Interfaith Alliance.
Part of the value of a non-government organization is the sense of consensus that it's able to bring to the table. That's one thing for Interfaith Alliance to stand up for the values that we support, and we do that religiously. But what's far more important is that when we represent those values, we can say we're not just speaking for a group of people sitting in an office in Washington, and we're not just speaking for the affiliates we have in states across the nation. We're speaking for a grassroots consensus among our members. And the larger the number of the blades of grass, the greater the consensus we have, the more effective we are in communicating what we're all about. Interfaith Alliance remains the only organization that approaches these issues with a positive attitude toward protecting faith in this country. I don't mean to criticize our partners in coalition, but there is almost a grudging acceptance that they have to protect the rights of religious communities, and religious communities with whom they may disagree on the eventual outcome of issues on which they advocate. I want to make sure that Mormons and conservative Christians and Orthodox Jews and Orthodox Muslims have the same rights and privileges and the same voice in American society as people who are part of those religious communities or who are themselves non-believers, who are atheists or agnostics, want to have in the community and can bring the values that flow from their philosophy or from their religious perspective to that conversation. Only the people listening to this program can amplify that voice to a point where it will be heard above the din of everybody else clamoring for one perspective or the other. And that's why not just a membership, but a contribution beyond membership to Interfaith Alliance to give us a monthly gift that would make you a torchbearer to participate in the activities that we have both nationally and around the country. Those are the things that will make us more effective in the values that those of you who are listening to this already share with us. So anything you can do to help us and everything you can do to help us will be greatly appreciated.
Jack, thanks for that. I have one more question before we go today, and I'm asking you to reflect on something out of your own faith tradition, even more than as the head of the Interfaith Alliance. We've all been concerned looking at what has gone on in Israel this past week with the elections. We certainly are all aware of the amount of excitement and controversy that came related to that in our own nation. I don't know what you feel comfortable talking about, but I wish you'd just share some of your thoughts about what's gone on in Israel over the last several weeks.
Well, thank you for asking me that question, and I want to make sure that I just echo what you said, that the comments I'm about to make are not reflective of the policies of Interfaith Alliance. We stay out of international affairs entirely, so Interfaith Alliance has no position right on anything in the Middle East. Look, I'm of two minds. On the one hand, I have to say that Israel is one of the very few democracies that has existed uninterrupted since its founding. In that sense, it has something very much in common with the United States. The transition of power has been peaceful. The people have spoken. They have elected the various pieces of their parliament, of their Knesset, and now they have to be put together by someone who will lead that government. That standard is a little different than we have here. But I would be remiss if I didn't note with alarm some of the things that were said by people campaigning for office in Israel that strike me as being counter to the values that drew me to apply for the position at Interfaith Alliance. In particular, the suggestion that the presumed victor in this election, Benjamin Netanyahu, has eschewed the notion that there will ever be a Palestinian state as long as he's prime minister. That represents a shift in policy for him. It represents a shift in policy for Israel, and it puts Israel at odds with what the express position of the American government has been through a number of administrations now. I'm also very concerned, as I have been in elections all over the world, including in this country, when essentially the race card is played. His call to his supporters to come out in greater numbers to the polls because Arabs were voting in the election in larger numbers than he expected or that the pollsters expected seems to me to not be the kinds of values that that at least the Israel that I grew up believing in would want to promote. There is room in a democratic society for everyone, and I would be concerned if that now reflects a new kind of exclusion in Israeli society. But having said that, I have to come back to the initial statement I made. It was a democratic process. It is above reproach. There is nobody who's suggesting that the election was rigged or stolen or in any way compromised. And the behavior of the candidates aside, I can't help but feel great pride that with everything going on in the Middle East, for more than 70 years, Israel has been able to maintain its democratic nature without interruption and without interference.
Rabbi Jack Moline is Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance. A dear friend, a longtime colleague, State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance, and you'll find more information on the vital work of protecting faith and freedom at interfaithalliance.org. Jack, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Will.
Now, before we go, I have a question for you. So how did you celebrate St. Patrick's Day? Named after the beloved patron saint of Ireland, here in the United States, the day long ago devolved into a secular excuse to collect shamrocks, wear green, and indulge in generous amounts of alcohol, all of which is frequently done in the context of a raucous parade. The past couple of years, however, have seen a concerted effort on the part of some to re-solemnize St. Patrick's Day. No, not by reducing the number of green glitter-covered paper hats or the nakedly pagan cult of the four-leaf clover or even the over-reliance on green beer. Defenders of the sanctity of St. Patrick's Day have focused instead on the real threat, the inclusion of LGBT participants in the sacred rite of the St. Patrick's Day parade. And so this year in New York City, Catholic Cardinal Timothy Dolan received criticism for not withdrawing a parade grand marshal after it was announced that an LGBT-identified group would march among the 300 other contingents. In Boston, the first ever inclusion of two LGBT groups, one of which consisted of American military veterans, was enough to spur the Knights of Columbus to drop out of the parade in protest. Are we living in a cartoon here? Last year, the perpetually shrieky head of the Catholic League, Bill Donahue, chased headlines by saying he wanted to march in New York City's gay pride parade carrying a straight pride banner. Imagine his surprise when parade organizers warmly approved of the idea. Naturally, he found reasons not to do it. but not before deflating the false equivalency between the heartlessly homophobic, exclusionary policies pursued by Donahue and his ilk and the way the rest of the world tends to operate. Folks, here's the thing. The first St. Patrick's Day parade happened in 1766 in New York City and gained popularity as the growing Irish population was brutally discriminated against. It was a defiant opportunity to celebrate an ancestry that for the rest of the year was overtly disparaged by such things as help wanted signs reading Irish need not apply. Yet as a brutally marginalized immigrant population grew in power and in respectability, is it even possible that nothing was learned? Is it even possible that today there are those who don their Kiss Me, I'm Irish buttons while also proclaiming gays need not apply? The only thing more ridiculous than this ironic discrimination is cloaking it in a mendacious fog of supposed religious liberty. Meanwhile, back on the Emerald Isle, the first gay member of Parliament has come out. In the year ahead, traditionally Catholic Ireland will be the first nation in the world to host a national referendum on marriage equality. On our side of the pond, a generation from now, the whole parade controversy will be a historical footnote. But it's a shame to see divisions created and resources expended to defend the religious integrity of a celebration that never has been religious. There are genuine Christian values that could be validated by the history of St. Patrick's Day in this country. But this is not them. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. I want to thank you if you've made a donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief. And we hope you share the stories that you hear on this show with your friends. We're also at twitter.com/stateofbelief. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Preacher man, the only boy who could ever teach me, was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.